The Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is a podcast dedicated to practical politics. Practical politics is, of course, called practical politics because it is all non-voting, which makes it very, very practical. Conventional politics is always rule-based politics. Every 2 years, every 4 years, it's basically what you do at the voting booth. And then there is full-spectrum practical politics, or engaging and taking down an opponent by any means necessary, using the rules but never breaking the rules. But to do anything, we have to start with practical politics, and in this case, it's the art of staying on message. It's having a consistent message. And our consistent message is a mantra, or white rabbit genocide you see on this front page. And we will also, in this podcast, engage in the geopolitical. We will talk about geopolitical events. We will talk about things from a unique white rabbit perspective. We will also go into white rabbit psychology and ecology and talk about everything you'd want to know about the indigenous white rabbits of Europe. And this is, again, the Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. Long, long ago, I introduced you to this podcast, Horus the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit. And in this particular podcast, we're going to talk about the Elitesters. But to talk about the Elitesters is really the simplest thing in the world, because they are what they say they are. What they say they are is something pretty interesting. And there's all kinds of evidence that may conclude that they are correct, whether it be real physical or circumstantial. But that's, we're going to go into that later on. But to lay out this particular Elitester podcast, I need to bring you up to date on something. This something is called an allegory. What's an allegory, Horace? Well, you've been listening to one. Horace, the Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is an allegory. It's an extended metaphor. I mean, we're not really white rabbits. And in this extended metaphor, we have another, even more complicated extended metaphor. What's a metaphor? Metaphor, an allegory would be like the Grim Reaper. The Grim Reaper is the one they give on Wikipedia. The Grim Reaper is an allegorical representation of death. It's not death, but when you send the Grim Reaper, you associate that with death. That is a basic allegory. That's a basic metaphor. The Green Goddess, of course, white rabbits would be what you see is what you get allegory. I mean, we're not really white rabbits, but white rabbits represent Europeans or white people. When you get into the Green Goddess, we're getting into an extended metaphor. An extended metaphor is something that's real, but not real in the way you think it's real. I mean, there's not really a big green lizard running across the planet for us. Or maybe there is. but it's an extended metaphor. And it actually, I ripped it off the Japanese. The Japanese got bombed. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, they got a neutron bomb dropped on them. They said the Godzilla came after them, you know. That's what they invented, this big destructive capability from the West. I thought that was pretty interesting because it's by and large true. Not that we had anything to do with it or want to do it, but Godzilla is a destructive component of the Green Goddess. In the cartoon, you're going to be introduced to another concept. The concept you're mostly going to hear about is the Green Goddess and the Godzilla. Good being good. She's good, but Godzilla, Goodzilla. You know, we use Godzilla and Horus Avengers Follow the White Rabbit because we are targeting the system of political correctness for destruction. And we make no bones about it, but that's an extended metaphor. Extended metaphors, at one time, were very easy for Europeans to catch on to. Very easy. They wouldn't be asking questions about what is that. What they would just figure it out immediately. We are so far removed from our natural thought processes that we don't even understand our own history or mythologies, and all of it's written in allegorical terms. It doesn't mean it's not true. It's just not necessarily true in the way you think it's true. We're also faced with another dilemma. We're faced with the dilemma of going back in time and reading allegories and not having the key code. Because in this particular podcast, you have me explain to you who the white rabbits are, and you can figure that out. I explained to you what the green goddess is. It's an allegorical representation of Western prowess, of technology, of all the crazy stuff we do. We got the head and the tail. The tail's all politics, and the head's all military, and all that type of stuff. Well, when you're looking back in time, and you're looking at, let's say, the Iliad or the Odyssey, Homer's Iliad or Homer's or the Odyssey, and you're looking back in time, you're trying to figure out an allegory that many people thought was mythology, but yet they find the walls of Troy. It's kind of like listening to this podcast, maybe if you're unfortunate enough to hear this 10,000 years in the future and you're trying to figure out why someone's trying to kill white rabbits. Then you figure out, oh, it's white people, yeah, those are real, yeah, Europeans are real. Then you're trying to figure out what the green goddess is and everything else. That's what you're faced with in the Odyssey. But the Odyssey was thought to be a mythology until they found the walls of Troy. Once you find the walls of Troy, once you realize that Europeans actually existed on this planet, 10,000 years in the future, let's say, you realize Europeans existed, then you hear white rabbit genocide, and you say, oh, someone's trying to kill them. You know, we're faced with something similar in our mythology, that the walls of Troy are real. What else is real in that mythology? What is real? What is a green goddess-type allegory? What's trying to tell us something? And what is what you see is what you get? What is real? What is an allegorical? And what is another type of extended metaphor, like a green goddess or something along those lines? It's easier said than done. But in this type of podcast, I've introduced you to a concept of an allegory. Most of you caught on to that. A whole group caught on to that. Some of you have been kind of resistant to it. That's simply because you're outside of your normal mode of thinking. Someone's trying to kill you. You're not in your, even what you consider normal for Western civilization, let's say in the 50s, that isn't going to be normal. No, we're never going to produce anything like that in our normal state. I know that's kind of hard for some to believe, but we're not. That is heavily manipulated even then. I used to think that the 1950s would have been ideal. That's an ideal white society, but it is not. It is far removed from our normal state. But allegories are something that tends to come quite naturally for us. We tend to, for a variety of different reasons, that has to do with how our minds work. The white rabbit's minds work very, well, the human brain works obviously in a unique way, and the white rabbits think and approach things in a very unique way. But typically, when you're listening to this podcast, keep in mind that we're dealing with allegories. We're dealing with allegories that are real. White rabbits are real. White rabbits and white people are real, and there's an attempted genocide against them. This is all true, but it's an allegory. The Green Goddess is real, but she's not really real. Just like the Grim Reaper's not really real. Death is real, but the Grim Reaper's not real. The Grim Reaper is just an allegorical representation of that. We're going to start bringing other mythologies to life. Into what you see is what you get fashion. And I'm going to tie it into the Leedsters. You see, this type of background, this type of groundwork is needed to tie in everything. The Leedsters are pretty quite forward and simple. Because you have to start at the position that they are what they say they are. And that goes into a very interesting area. And we're going to talk about this next. I'm going to lay several different foundations to basically show you what they say they are. It's pretty straightforward. It's pretty simple. In fact, it's one of the simplest podcasts to do. It's so simple, approaching it becomes rather difficult because you got to kind of set it up and tie in together all kinds of different things we've talked about. But in the next little piece, I'm going to talk about Y chromosomes. And this is important for you to understand. This is the most critical thing for any anti-Semite to understand. I'll be back with you here in a minute. But keep in mind allegories. If you're listening to this and you're a white male, I'm guessing there's more than a few of you, or even if you're a white female, you most likely have a brother, you definitely have a father, you definitely probably maybe have uncles, maybe you have a son, a little brother, so on and so forth. You realize that white males I mean, if you're not completely brain dead, you realize that white males are attacked a certain way in the media and academia and everything else. That's probably old news to many of my listeners. But you realize that something on this planet doesn't like white males. And that's something, believe it or not, is at the top of Western civilization. We're talking about the Jew rabbits. Well, certainly, they have a great deal of media power in Hollywood, the Hollywood media, as it's called now. And they don't like white males. I think that we can universally agree with that. But the next little piece we're going to talk about why. We're going to talk about the nitty-gritty. We're going to talk about why chromosomes. The difference between pink rabbits, pink rabbit banksters, and leadsters, the difference between basically the top and the bottom of the pink rabbits is, you know, on one end you have just rabbits that look like us and have no loyalty to us, and that applies to all of them, basically. But the differentiation is, by and large, Y chromosomes. What is a Y chromosome? Y chromosome makes a male male. Y chromosomes are only carried by males. Y chromosomes can only be traced through male lines. Y chromosomes cannot be traced through female lines. And this is an interesting point for every little anti-Semite to know, because your enemy does something in front of your face, and none of you have ever caught on to this. Very few. Definitely no one that talks on Stormfront or publicly or anything else, and it's important for you to understand. In European tradition, we know now scientifically, my main sleuth came out with a book called Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. And it's such a monster, his other book that he brought out called The Grid of the Gods has been put on ice. And since it's been put on ice, Amazon won't distribute it, or Amazon's taken their time in distributing it. Why did they do that? Well, there's two ways that our enemy treats someone who talks about the truth. You have the Dr. Kevin McDonald, who writes about the Jews from his particular standpoint, his particular theories. And you can look him up. They'll attack him outright. There's another way to talk about someone or to treat someone that's onto the truth. And that other way to treat someone is to put them in the ice. Put them in Siberia, you know, ignore them, make it hard for them to distribute their stuff, don't attack them directly, don't bring attention to them. But the Dr. Farrell, Dr. Joseph P. Farrell, has delivered what I wanted him to deliver for my listeners, in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. He's coming out with it. And what's he talking about? He's talking about Y chromosomes. He's talking about Y chromosomes. But in the European tradition, we know that all white rabbits come from seven mothers. Six are indigenous to Europe. Six. The seven, it comes from the Middle East, the seventh. And I can speculate on her to no end, based on previous ages and everything else. But they also come from 10 fathers. We have 10 fathers. So any particular white rabbit could trace their maternal line, male or female, down to one of those seven mothers. But, here's the thing, only the males could find out what father they're from. The Y chromosome could only be traced through the males of a family. Y chromosome creates all differentiation. All the non-coding DNA in a white rabbit are contained in a Y chromosome. They're contained in the males. Non-coding DNA is also called junk DNA, which many believe white males have different type of junk DNA than others. That's why they call it junk DNA, which is probably something they would do. It's called junk DNA since it's in white males. But males contain non-coding DNA or junk DNA. And that's just DNA that hasn't been turned on yet. DNA is there for some particular reason. The Russian scientists talk about it being like computer programs that no one's turned on yet. It's just not running. It's a big mystery. Finding out about it is a big mystery. But any white male could trace themselves back to one of 10. And I have a lot of question marks about the 10 original fathers. The females we know all about. We know their clans. We know where they're from. If you're reading Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, you know all about it. The Sykes. Sykes was a scientist over in the UK. He's wrote all about these seven ancient mothers. We know every inch of them. But what's interesting, if you're a female listening, you can only trace what Y chromosome you're related to through the males. You can't trace that through females. It's very interesting stuff. Fascinating stuff, because right now we have an enemy that has revealed itself. In the 20th century, it's what you see is what you get. People at the top of Western civilization don't like white rabbits. They're trying to kill us. That's a very unnatural situation. The Emperor of China does not try to kill off all the Chinese. wiping out some of the Chinese like Chairman Mao did, that's one thing. There's a billion Chinese. Who cares? To the Chairman Mao's. I mean, the Chinese care, but Chairman Mao doesn't care about killing 40, 50 million. There's tons of them. They can just have more. But if Chairman Mao steps up and tries to kill all the Chinese, especially all the Chinese males, and use the females for something else, or have ideals for the females, well, it's very weird stuff. It's very unnatural. And when you're in an unnatural situation, we have to ask some solid questions. And the questions come down to Y chromosomes. The differentiation between a pink rabbit elitesters and everyone else is always a Y chromosome. How do we know this? Well, we don't know it for sure because we haven't seen their DNA, just like none of my listeners know exactly which Y chromosome they're related to. But based on one simple thing, it's what they say. Fascinating thing about the little Jew rabbits is that they link themselves to a maternal line. If you're a little Jew rabbit, you can go to Israel, you can get citizenship by being related to some ancient mother. It's interesting stuff. But what's even more interesting is the family that formed Israel, the Rothschilds, which is what you see is what you get, Jew rabbit, bankster, Jew rabbit, elitester. In this case, we'll make him an elitester automatically. He doesn't claim any maternal descent at all. They don't even talk about their maternal descent. You've never seen the Rothschilds come in and grant Israeli citizenship. That's not how that works. The Rothschilds, they own the place. Basically, they're considered heavily. All the different court buildings and everything else have been done by them. The state of Israel probably wouldn't exist without the Rothschild family. There is what you see is what you get, Jew, rabbit, elitester. They're at the top of the heap in that group. But they don't claim anything. They don't claim maternal links at all. That's not what they talk about. Not to say that they aren't, but that's not what they talk about. What they talk about over and over again, and this is easily researched, is a Y chromosome. They descend from the Nimrods. They descend from the Geborim. That's what they say. So meanwhile, all the little Jew rabbits are going over to Israel. They're claiming an X chromosome. Every little Jew rabbit can trace himself back to this X chromosome, back to this female. Right? But the guys at the top, they don't talk about that at all. They talk about something that can only be traced through the males. That can only be traced through a Y chromosome. In other words, the only way you could trace that is through Jewish males. And I'm guessing only a small percentage have it. And that small percentage would be called the elitesters, would differentiate. And we're going to go into a little bit of their structure, how they operate, how this group operates. But that's something to keep in mind. We're dealing with Y chromosomes here. We're speculating on Y chromosome. Their mythology lays it out quite clear. It's quite clear. We're going to go into that in a few minutes. But in their mythology, one thing becomes clear. Y chromosomes matter. Y chromosome is everything. But I think it's interesting that right in front of the world, they claim this X chromosome descent. But at the top, that's all they talk about is Y chromosomes. All they talk about is what males they descend from, and it would be impossible to tell through the females. Interesting. And by the way, I don't even know if the average Jew could even have the test done. The average European cannot have a test done to find out which male they're coming from. And not enough is known by the Y chromosomes. I'm guessing everything is known, it just hasn't been revealed yet for certain reasons. If you're talking about Zeus and Europa, you're talking about a Y chromosome. You're talking about the Viracochas. You're talking about the quasicodals, the Kukulcans. You're talking about Y chromosomes. You're talking about the Yahweh of the Old Testament. You're talking about a Y chromosome. All over the world, there is all these talks about gods descending and having children with human females. Well, you're always dealing with a Y chromosome, aren't you? Yeah. When you start dealing with Odin or Thor, you're dealing with Y chromosomes. Interesting stuff. But our enemy at the top makes a clear distinction. What you see is what you get distinction. And you can actually find this out in my main sleuth's books, whether it be in The Cosmic War, he starts laying it out, and Bankster's, Babylon's Banksters, he talks about the Rothschilds and all the different documentation about what they say they're related to, the Nimrods, the Geborim. And we're going to tie some loose ends together for you, or I'm going to try to. Why the absolute truth isn't known, the direction is pretty easy to ascertain. And it is what you see is what you get. And in the next little piece, we're going to talk about royalty. We're going to talk about the power royalty has. We're going to talk about our enemy's actual structure. How do they operate? I'll give you a basic overview. When you're dealing with our enemy, a few things come out very quickly, even when you're dealing with the little Jew rabbits in Judaism. Judaism deals with a very advanced concept. That's not something most of them could come up with. For instance, I'll give you one, Agrigor. An Agrigor, of course, is a group god. And that is spelled E-G-R-E-G-O-R-E. When you hear them talk about Hashem, Hashem is an Agrigor. It's a heavy-duty occult concept. The standard definition is collective group mind. But it's an Agrigor. It's a little group god. And that's what Hashem is. This is not something they could invent. This is something that had to be given to them. The only groups nowadays that deal with Agrigors, the Peanut Gallery just said corporate America. Yeah, corporate America. The Fortune 500 companies can, if you ever work for one, act like little Agrigors, a little group gods. But barring the anti-corporate view of some of the Peanut Gallery, typically when you're dealing with Agrigors, you're dealing with Rosicrucian type concepts. Rosicrucians is something, it's a sort of Masonic society. Well, not sort of, it is. It's quote unquote secret society. Benjamin Franklin belonged to it and whatnot. And typically if you look up Rosicrucians, you go to their website, you're going to see that it all is Egyptian. And when you get with our enemy, you go back to Egypt. Egypt, I've always went over and over again with you, is a big question mark. I know the questions to ask. I don't necessarily have all the answers. And in this podcast, we'll start filling in more for you with pictures and whatnot. But Agrigor is a very advanced concept. It's not a concept some little Jew or some little rabbi is just going to come up with. It's a group god. Hashem is a group god. It's a fear-based control mechanism. Hashem is going to get you. You know, like it says, Agrigor is an occult concept representing a thought form or collective group mind, an autonomous psychic entity made up of influence and thoughts of a group of people. The symbiotic relationship between an Agrigor and its group has been compared to the more recent non-occult concept of a corporation. It's kind of interesting. But Agrigor is a very interesting concept. You get some very advanced control techniques like this in Judaism that most Jews are very unaware of. They're not exactly going to be able to pull that out of the hat. When you get into Egypt, my big question mark is the Hyksos and Akhenaten. And you're going to understand why in a little bit. But when you get into Hyksos, how could they wander into Egypt and all of a sudden get Agrigors? Well, that had to come from a priest class. It had to come from someone pretty advanced. These are advanced occultic concepts. Controlling people through fear. Black magic. Other things like that. These aren't things that just some desert dwellers are going to come up with on their own. They have to have a lot of help. And, of course, we have all hands pointing back to Egypt and potentially a priest class there. But when you start cracking this group down, breaking this group down, you realize there's a little more there than meets the eye. There's got to be a lot going on at the top. And their control structure is, by and large, in my opinion, fraternal organizations that hijack other fraternal organizations. And there's a pretty big event in Western civilization that's always pointed out to. That's always been pointed out as one of the keys, and that is, I hate using this term, but Bavarian Illuminati. A lot of people use this term, but they don't define it. They were a fraternal organization that were hijacking other fraternities. They weren't playing by the rules. And they got booted out. Why'd they get booted out? Because if a fraternal organization, a Masonic fraternity, has to have a charter. The Anti-Defamation League of Canada and the Anti-Defamation League of the United States, they both have charters. Those charters are extended by the head of the Masonic fraternities globally, usually somewhere in London, and they always answer to royalty. In other words, if a Masonic fraternity is operating under a charter, it's because someone wants them to have a charter and someone signed on to it. And that someone always has something to do with royalty, in my opinion. If the Queen of England wanted the Anti-Defamation League, she was ticked off at them, and she wanted them to stop operating in Canada, she'd revoke their charter. They're over with. They're done with. Why? She has divine right of kings. And divine right of king, does that come from female? No. That's all Y chromosome stuff, isn't it? That's the type of power these people have. So if you see the Anti-Defamation League operating in America, and you look at their charter, their Masonic fraternity, not necessarily talking about the SPLC, that's a different group, but you're dealing with the Anti-Defamation League. And you're dealing with the Anti-Defamation League in Canada, you're dealing with Masonic fraternities. Masonic fraternities always answer. They do what they're told. They have charters. They are operating and harassing white rabbits because someone at the top wants them there. If they don't want them there, they're not going to be there. The Illuminati is one such structure that someone didn't want around, and they got kicked out of Germany. It's pretty famous. But that's just a word. It's a fraternal organization that hijacks other fraternal organizations, which is against the rules. You're not supposed to do that, apparently. But Mar Enemy's structure is generally a third column. You have two major Masonic fraternities in the West. One, let's say in Anglosphere, you have basically the American Masonics, the Masons that were handed down from the American Revolution. You have all the different United Kingdom, the Scottish Rites and whatnot. You have all the, let's say, the Gentile Masonic fraternities. And then you have the Jewish fraternities. Well, the Elitzers basically thread both of those different structures. They're a third column. They're a fraternal organization that belongs to other fraternities, but that they represent their own interest, in my opinion. These are just my two cents. Much the same as Illuminati was accused of doing. But that is just a word. Let's think in terms of concepts. A fraternal organization that hijacks other fraternities. You know, they belong to the Scottish Rites, but they're not really Scottish Rites. George W. Bush belongs to this, but he's not really this. He's something else, answering to something else. Again, you're dealing with a fraternal, a third column that can be threaded down, whether it be the Jewish fraternities or the Jewish Masonic fraternities or the Gentile Masonic fraternities. That doesn't mean anything to them. They're beholden to another interest. Is that against the charter? Yeah, you're technically not supposed to be doing that, but they don't tend to play by the rules. They have been kicked out, sure. They've been kicked out, but by and large, that's what you're dealing with here. So it doesn't really matter. Ist and isms don't really matter. They'll change their ist and isms overnight. Politics don't mean anything. They're not idealistic. They have an objective. Their objective is very ancient. It's a New World Order. They are differentiated between Elitester and regular Pink Rabbit, even in the bankster set. Even if you look at the what you see is what you get Rothschilds, they are differentiated always by who they claim as a Y chromosome. The average little Jew doesn't claim a Y chromosome. They claim a maternal line that links them to all the little Jew rabbits of the world. That can only be traced, that can be traced through any little Jew, and it is a female. You see, any maternal line can be traced through every rabbit on earth. Every rabbit on earth can find out what maternal line they're related to. In Europe, every single white rabbit can trace his or her, link to one of the seven mothers. But only the males can trace the Y chromosome. You would have, if you're a little girl rabbit, white rabbit, to find out what male you're related to, one of the 10 ancient males that fathered the Indo-European or the Aryan race, well, you would have to trace that to your brothers and whatnot. Interesting stuff. Fascinating. But that is what differentiates pink rabbits. And we differentiate them that way because that's what they say. Historically, that's what they say. They say they're related to something. Even when it comes to the Rothschilds, they say it time and time again. And we will speculate on more of them in a little bit. But the reason all this stuff is going on is because someone at the top wants it to go on. If they didn't want them to have charters, tomorrow morning they wouldn't have charters. And if they want them to lay off or change something, they will have to change something immediately because they answer to somebody. That's how Masonic fraternities operate. But when you're dealing with their governing structure, you're dealing with the ruling structure, without getting too complicated, you're dealing with a fraternal organization that hijacks other fraternal organizations. It doesn't matter whether they're Scottish Rites. It doesn't matter whether they're this corporation. It doesn't matter whether they claim to be your local rabbi. That doesn't mean anything to them. They're looking at something totally different based on what they say. And so that's important to come as we start going into the next section. That's how they operate by and large. But in the next section, we're going to go into, and I'm going to tie in, we're going back to Egypt. We're going back into what I call the third rail of speculation. And the third rail of speculation is something very fun. It's something very fun. If you're an anti-Semite, you will like this, even for propaganda purposes. But it gets into some pretty interesting areas. And it has to do with what they say they are. They always claim this type of stuff. And we're going into, the third rail of speculation goes into the Old Testament. And we're going into Akhenaten. And we're also going to start bringing a piece of mythology to life. I'm going to show you a few pictures. We're going to tie in a few loops. Questions, I got more questions than answers, but I can get you right on top of where the answer should come from. If there's truth, this is the direction it's going to go. And we'll be back with you in a minute, and I'll start that process. Yeah, it's pretty simple talking about the Elitzers, but you got to kind of set it up, and most of you are ready for this type of setup. So we'll take the straightest route. I'm going to do a brief question and answer as we transition into the third rail of speculation. And that question and answer, I'm going to set up the third rail of speculation. But to answer the question, do I think our enemy is gray aliens? No, there's no evidence of that. There's no physical evidence of that. The gray aliens are normally propaganda coming out of World War II having to do with our enemy's New World Order. Do I think our enemy are green lizards or green lizards from another dimension? I've never seen anything like that. There is no physical evidence of anything like that ever walking on this planet. Typically, when you're dealing with the feathered serpents of South America, you are dealing with an allegorical reference to someone that brought them civilization, that brought them knowledge. The serpent can also be, they can mean earth. For instance, if you've seen in Western tradition, Gigantomachy, from the Greek tradition, you have giants, and if you look it up, Gigantomachy, you're going to see giants with serpents for legs. They didn't actually have serpents for legs. That's trying to tell you something. In the Greek tradition, we have the satyrs, and the satyrs, of course, are the half man, half goat. There are a whole line of thinking that believe that's an allegorical representation of the Neanderthals, to some extent. In other words, you have something half man and half animal. Interesting, but these are allegories. That doesn't mean they're not true. They're just not true in the way you think they are. Typically, the white gods of South America are always portrayed as the Kukulkans, the Quetzalcoatls, the Viracochas, as a feathered serpent. But that's because they brought knowledge or civilization. It has nothing to do with the fact that they were serpents. There's no evidence that any big green lizard, blood-drinking lizard, walks this planet. Not to say they aren't true. I'm just saying there isn't any physical evidence. There is physical evidence. To back up, there is archaeological evidence to back up what our enemy says they are, based on their own mythologies, based on our own mythologies, based on physical and archaeological evidence. There isn't any DNA evidence that they've revealed, but there is circumstantial evidence with what's going on now. And this is what's important for you to understand. We're going to bring to life another mythology. In the mythologies of the world, one thing becomes clear. Actually, two things. One, everyone talks about some flood that happened way back. This is universal. Everyone talks about some flood and some flood hero. What's interesting about the flood that happened way back, there's no evidence that it necessarily happened on this planet. That's another story for another day. But there's another part of mythology that goes all over the place, and it's kind of interesting. For instance, they talk about giants, and giants are giants out of the Odyssey. You have the Polyphemus. Polyphemus is the big cyclops, and he's eating people. There's other giants that are eating people, and they're the sons of Poseidon. Children of Poseidon, the wild giants and the wicked giants and whatnot. They also make the Bible. Giants are the offspring of fallen angels and human women. And of course, for this particular discussion, we're going to actually go one step further. We're going to define giants or Nephilim, if that's what you want to use, in absolute terms. Nephilim is a very dangerous word. But we can, as long as we define it, we're okay. Giants, for topics of this discussion, we're dealing with something a lot bigger than us, with severely misshapen skulls, totally different than us. In the mythologies of the world, giants are not considered human, and they aren't considered animal. They're generally presented as a chimerical being, whether it be in the Greek tradition with serpents as their legs, with most believe that means that they were from the earth, they were original inhabitants of the earth. They're presented as ogres with misshapen skulls. There's always something wrong with their melons. Always something going wrong upstairs. Always something different about them. And when we find them in archaeological digs, there generally is something wrong with their heads. They have misshapen skulls, severely misshapen skulls. But when you're just talking about a 9-foot-tall German found in a German forest that looks to be perfectly normal and European, that's not necessarily a giant or Nephilim in my book. That doesn't mean anything to me. They always have to have a misshapen skull because that's what they have in mythology. What's funny about the mythology is they had some pretty interesting tastes and desires, whether it be cannibalism. They're generally associated, even biblically, with chimeras. We're going to go into that. They are also associated with, presented as chimeras, presented as neither human or animal, something else. They also have some pretty weird tastes and desires. In the one particular legend, God sends fire from heaven because they were buggering each other in public. Two male giants were buggering each other in public. In other words, they were doing something that got on God's nerves, and he sent fire down and destroyed them. And we're not talking Sodom and Gomorrah. We're talking about Aztec mythology. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Thousands and thousands of miles away from Sodom and Gomorrah, we have something very similar among a group of giants, and they get annihilated. Interesting enough. But we're always going to define it in absolute terms as something a lot larger than us with something wrong with its head. Different misshapen heads. And they're generally considered totally different by the early church fathers, the early church thinkers, early Christian thinkers. Greek mythology, they're considered totally different. And their skulls and bones are found all over the planet. Well, and your next question is, Horace, what does this have to do with pink rabbit leechers? Okay. Well, I'm going to show you a picture, and we're going to start tying in some knots as we enter the third rail speculation. In the third rail speculation, you have an interesting character that shows up on the scene. His name is Yahweh. Come to find out that's not actually a name at all, but that's another story we're going to get to in a few minutes. But in the third rail speculation, we have an interesting phenomenon. Yahweh shows up and won't show his face. We know this to be true, whether it be the Torah or the Talmud. In our enemy's mythology, their God will not show his face. Now, historically, Yahweh is an interesting term. Let me let the cat out of the bag. It is generally thought to be a pun, by some groups a pun, reference to Ea or Enki, Poseidon. But most of us now believe it to mean CEO. You know, I'm the boss here running the planet right now. I'm the representative of the Anunnaki running the planet. And when Yahweh shows up, usually, you know, he's walking around the garden, he's hanging out, it's Enlil hanging out with his rabbits doing this, doing that, but they don't really hide their faces. So we have someone showing up saying he's Yahweh and won't show his face. Here, God will not show his face. Very interesting. Could be worried about some bacterial infection or something like that, or... as they present in Genes, Giants, and Monsters and Men, and as I'm going to show you, maybe there's a different reason. Now, right now, what I want you to do is I'm going to start pulling this together. You're going to go to my Twitter, and you're going to look up Granny Pink Rabbit 1 and Granny Pink Rabbit 2. You're never going to see anything like this presented in the major media. We've talked about Akhenaten, haven't we? We've talked about the Hyksos and the Hyksos coming into Egypt. We've talked about our enemy's origin and the big questions I have. But now I'm going to show you why we have these questions. When Akhenaten took over Egypt, he turned Egypt upside down. They redid all the artwork. He's presented as some androgynous giant, some big giant, in the artwork. And there's all kinds of busts going on. One of the famous busts from that period, from the Amarna period, is the bust of Nefertiti. And the bust of Nefertiti is considered true form. In other words, that's considered her real look, her real head. There's nothing abnormal about her. She looks like a modern European woman, I think most of us can understand. The bust of Nefertiti, it's in a German museum right now. But there's a lot of other busts. And these busts come from Akhenaten's daughter. And there's a lot of strange things in the artwork. The exaggerated features, the androgynous form of the males. And the most important one is I'm going to show you right now. Pull up Granny Pink Rabbit 1. It's called cultcase.com and has several different mysterious skulls. And before we get into debating giants or giant tribes and stuff like that, that's irrelevant to this discussion. We're going to keep it very simple. I'm going to keep it to what we know to be true. What we know to be true is if you head down the page, you're going to come across Peruvian skulls. These are associated with the Nazca lines at one time. And these things are huge. You're going to see a giant misshapen skull. Now, if you're a skeptic like me, you're going to ask if that's a result of skull binding. No. Skull binding was a result of natives seeing these and binding their skull. Skull binding cannot make the cranial void larger. You cannot have a larger cranial void by skull binding. Skull binding is basically something certain tribes did to misshape the skulls, to make the skulls pointy, to make it like cone heads. What you see in those Peruvian skulls were actually skulls of giants. Those are the real deal. If you've seen the book or if you read the book Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, on the front cover, that's an actual real skull. That's not make-believe. That's the real deal. So they were up to 9 to 15 feet tall. The ones they found in Alaska, and this is interesting enough, some of them they found in Alaska, they found this all over North and South America. You see, if there's something big going on in this planet, you're not going to be able to hide it archaeologically. It doesn't matter whether it's little gray aliens, green serpents from another dimension, or giants with huge misshapen skulls that are fighting this ancient war with humanity. You're not going to be able to hide it. Some kid's going to turn over a grave in, let's say, Alaska, and they're going to make the paper. It's pretty weird-looking stuff. And that's what has happened over and over again. At the forefront of hiding this stuff, of course, in North America would be the Smithsonian. And we'll get to that in a minute. But as you look at the Peruvian skulls, you're going to see a familiar character. You're going to see Akhenaten. You're going to see a piece of artwork. And artwork tells you a lot about a civilization. If artwork in any particular civilization gets turned upside down overnight, you can assume something happened there, especially at a state level. If the state level, they're sponsoring radical different art, and you have some pretty interesting things going on in the art, you better pay attention to what art's going on. And this is a big mystery to our enemy. What's going on in the Old Testament? Do I know 100% sure that Akhenaten is Moses? I'm not 100%, but I'm 99.9 and willing to bet a lot of money. But right next to that, you're going to see, right next to the artwork of Akhenaten, you're going to see another piece of artwork. That's Akhenaten's daughter. Check out her melon. You've seen Nefertiti. Nefertiti's actual bust of Nefertiti was real. This is another bust they kicked out. Is that really her daughter's head? His daughter's head? Well, that is heavily debated. Heavily debated. Typically, everything in the Amarna period is exaggerated, with the exception of certain busts they put out, like the bust of Nefertiti. Even Nefertiti can be exaggerated on pyramid art. On state-sponsored art. But when you come down to the busts are considered to be legitimate. Do we know that they had larger cranial void? It's been leaked that they do have larger cranial voids. Do they have it exaggerated like his daughter? And you're going to see another one, Pink Rabbit 2. Granny Pink Rabbit number 2, I'll call her. And when you see this, you're going to take a look at this bust. This bust is not painted. Typically, Nefertiti's, all her busts were painted, and this one would have been painted at one time. But you're seeing a bust of Akhenaten's daughter. Is this Akhenaten's daughter with Nefertiti? That isn't known. I believe it's with his sister, Akhenaten's sister. But anyways, this is Akhenaten's daughter. This is the way they represented her in art in a true form bust. And you see her face is pretty, there's not too much exaggerated in the face, but then you look at the head. You have a huge cranial void. Do I think it was that misshapen? No. No, I have problems believing it was, but we don't know for sure yet. Do we think that King Tut and Akhenaten had larger cranial voids? That is widely believed. It wasn't that exaggerated. But this female, obviously, they're showing her with a huge exaggerated cranial void for some reason. Never before in Egyptian art had this been done like this. This is radical. Is there anything to match that? Well, yes. We have a God of the Old Testament that won't show his face. He will not show his face. We know his size. We know his basic dimensions. We know that he's has two arms, two legs, needs food and whatnot. But that is the third rail of speculation. Who is this character? And it's not little gray aliens. It's not green lizards. It's a little bit more simple than that. It's something we actually have historical evidence existed. What they were all about, well, we'll have to speculate on that further on down the road in this podcast. But when you're looking at this, when you're looking at Akhenaten's daughter, well, that's by and large what they say they are. That's the Gabor. That's the descendants of Nimrods. That type of thing. And we're going to now go into third rail speculation. But when you're looking at this, you cannot have, skull binding cannot extend the cranial void. You can't make the cranial void bigger. You can't make the head bigger. You can reshape it, but you can't make it bigger. And what you're looking at are actual skulls of huge, huge creatures that existed at one time, humanoid-like creatures on this planet. We know this for a fact. Those that have read Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men, he talks about similar skulls like this that were a lot bigger than these, 2 feet across, being found in Alaska. Those are big, big skulls. All these have been found across ancient Europe, At one time, based on the mythology of the world, there was a fight, even excluding European mythology. If you were to look at all the mythology with the exception of Europe, you'd come to the conclusion that there's two things common. One is some type of flood happened somewhere, everyone talks about. Two, there was a war going on between humanity and non-humanity. And humanity was led by very human-like gods, very human-like gods. And the other side was led by very inhuman elements. And they didn't look human. They weren't considered human. They had strange appetites, strange tastes. But when you're looking at this photo, I'm going to come back to this over and over again when we're dealing with Akhenaten. It's important to know because this has to do with your enemy's mythology. It has to do with the third rail speculation, speculating on who this character is that shows up. And the third rail speculation goes way back in European tradition. It was very controversial at first for reasons we're going to go into next. Most of us, when we come into religion, most of my listeners would be Christians or would be Christians at one time. You come from the two standpoints: one, that it has to be true or it's all true, and we got to believe it or burn in hell, or that it's a complete mythology and we should ignore it because it's all Jew stuff. Or maybe one extreme or the other or somewhere in between, right? Typically when you get into the evangelicals, they can't question the Old Testament because they'll burn in hell. You have so many different types of Christians and what they believe and so on and so forth. The third rail of speculation takes a radical different approach. The third rail of speculation has its roots in history. And it takes a different approach that, okay, this may be Jewish mythology in the Old Testament, but when it comes to Exodus and Leviticus, well, we've got to figure out what's going on because we got an enemy here that wages war by deception. There may be something they're not telling us. And it has its roots. One of the biggest scandals in Western civilization comes out of the third rail of speculation. And it started with this. It starts with, as Joseph P. Farrell and Jeans, Giants, Monsters, and Men write so well, Dalich's Dilemma, Babel on Beeble. And Frederick Dalich, and that's Friedrich Dalitzsch. He lived from 1815 to 1922, and he was a German Assyriologist. And many of you have heard that name because the Nazis talked a lot about him. Babylon Bibel. And he was a big deal, and he got called in front of Kaiser Wilhelm II. Those of that have read Dr. Farrell's latest tomes have come across this in Gene Shot's Monsters and Men as he goes into third rail speculation, as I call it. Well, the problem, in short, is quite simple. There's a name used in the Old Testament. The name is a name from the Anunnaki. The name is a name from an ancient Sumer named Yahweh. Yahweh, unfortunately, in Dalitzsch's dilemma, the reason he got called in front of the Kaiser is you have a big problem. What this Assyriologist had uncovered is that this name was used at a minimum of 1,000 to maybe even 1,500 years prior to being revealed to Moses. In other words, Yahweh reveals himself exclusively to Moses as Yahweh. Well, he couldn't reveal himself exclusively to Hammurabi 1,500 years prior. It's a problem. You have the same name used in ancient Sumer and then used again in Egypt revealing himself to Moses. And this caused a huge scandal in Europe. Huge scandal among Christianity. It basically blows open, or some would say, as the Nazis would say, blows apart most of the Old Testament, or at least Exodus, Leviticus, and several different parts. But come to find out, what we know to be true now, and there are those that believe one or the other, and I kind of believe both, that Yahweh is in fact a title. If you're in the Catholic Church, you know that Yahweh, they've done some different things with Yahweh over the past few years. They're not using it the same way. Well, it's a title. The title among the Anunnaki means CEO, board of directors. You know, if I arrive at your company, you arrive at a company, you don't know any of the company's terminology, let's say General Electric, and I'm sitting there and I say, I'm the CEO. You know, you might think my name's CEO. You don't know how a company runs. You don't know anything about that. That I'm saying I'm the chief executive officer. You might think that that's my name, and I just keep saying I'm CEO. Well, you don't know jack squat, and I'm telling you what to do, and if you don't do it, I'm shooting you, killing you, whatever. You end up one of those situations in the Old Testament where you have a title being given. That's an interesting title, but it is just that, a title, and there are those that believe it's a pun. You know, tell them Ea sent you, or a reference to Ea, that side of the pantheon. But you always have to go back into the Anunnaki, into paleo-ancient civilizations, because this is used in the Old Testament. Their titles are used all over the Old Testament, especially this Yahweh. But generally accept it, that it is some type of pun, most certainly, because you're dealing with a language that continuously has all kinds of puns in it. Most of you think it's ancient Hebrew. Well, there is no ancient Hebrew language. That's a pun in itself. It's actually the language of Canaan. And there are several different variations, and all of them have various different puns. It's kind of like 5,000 years from now, someone said, well, they were speaking the American language. In North America, they spoke the American language. You would laugh and say, no, that's the English language. And America was part of Anglosphere, and they all spoke the English language. But you see, in this type of conversation, we have to be somewhat precise because we're talking about history. So in the language of Cana, when you start talking about why this term was used in Sumer with Hammurabi, it was used in Hammurabi, we have the actual cuneiforms. And this word was used again with Moses, Yahweh. It's basically a title. It's a title of the Anunnaki. In other words, whoever's here among the Anunnaki claims that title and their boss, their CEO. But when it comes to the Old Testament, one of the fascinating things is you have someone who shows up here in Exodus and Leviticus and is acting radically different than them. He has some radical different features. One, you know, most of the Anunnaki, as they call them in Dr. Pharaoh, is going through the third rail speculation like he does things through a third party. He's using this group, this husband and wife team named O'Brien. And they tear down the Old Testament. And generally, the third rail speculation, just so you know, you take Exodus, Leviticus, and what they do to the Old Testament is generally they'll take a blowtorch to it. Some of this stuff is scalding. It's like nothing you've ever read or been exposed to if you've been a Christian your whole entire life. Well, what Dr. Farrell did is he takes a tactical nuke and throws it at the Old Testament. Which, of course, is something that has always interested me. This has always interested me because this is my enemy's nationalism, no matter how you shape it. So if you want to start throwing a tactical nuke at it, that's fine. And the reason I say it's a tactical nuke and not just a flamethrower like the O'Briens is because he actually has a doctorate in patristics, which is early church history, from Oxford. So if you have a group of people who are just third rail speculators who are educated somewhat in ancient languages and are speculating, that's one thing. If you have someone who has a doctorate in patristics from Oxford who wants to throw neutron bombs at the Old Testament, that's a whole different level. This is the first time someone with some authority has done so publicly. And he's naming their god. They're speculating on who he is from the Anunnaki. But the Anunnaki are these shining ones. These are giant Aryans, by and large. Horus, can we ever escape this stuff? No, you can't, because it's in your Bible. It's all over the place. And we have to get in our enemy's mythology. And unfortunately, their mythology is combined for a certain reason. You have these giant, shiny white rabbits that came here, and you have two sides of the pantheon that went to war. One side was thrown down and may be here right now. That's the problem. You know, the devil got thrown down. But anyways, the debate is how big they are. Generally, you're dealing with, when you deal with the Anunnaki, the shining ones, the Olympians, you're dealing with something under 10 foot, 8 to 10 feet, something like that. When you're dealing with what you're dealing with in the Old Testament, whoever claims the title Yahweh, you're dealing with something above 10 feet. He does a very good job of explaining this, mostly closer to 13, maybe even a little bit bigger. You also have some very strange attributes that comes out. When he cuts his deal with Moses, and this is important for you to understand, he cuts two deals, basically. He cuts a deal with Moses, and the Israelites have to do whatever Moses says. And then he cuts another deal with, I believe it's Aaron. He goes into this in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. So we have basically two deals, and when Aaron gets out of line, he starts questioning Moses, or questioning following Moses, he gets called into the carpet. And what Dr. Farrell's doing in this approach is he's using modern technology. He's overlaying modern technology, modern psychology, Modern psychological manipulation techniques in over Exodus and Leviticus. And it is quite a read. It is like nothing I've ever really read before, the approach he took. It is scalding. If you're a Christian and you're very Old Testament based, you might want to be aware of this stuff is out there. He does some very scalding things with this character. But his attributes are radically different than, let's say, Zeus. This is not the same character. As Dr. Farrell points out, this is not Enlil walking around. This is not Zeus. Enlil is Zeus, basically. Enlil is Zeus in the Sumerian pantheon. He's not walking around showing us how to plant crops. This is guys just sitting here murdering people. You know, when Yahweh first walks out of the tent of the meeting after the deal with Moses, he murders two boys, lighting incense to them. He consumes them with fire. And what Dr. Farrell does in this stakes, he said, well, this can be done with modern technology. And that's true. Basically, the case he's making in his book is that a group shows up here. We have tares among the wheat, and a group shows up here. And they show up here in, well, where you think of as the Old Testament. I, of course, talk about Moses being Akhenaten. I, of course, go a little bit deeper. When I expose you to Moses being Akhenaten, that is a third rail speculation. Who is it if it's here? You know, what he's doing is going down the God line. He's not saying Moses is Akhenaten. I say that. He's not letting you in on everything, but I'm speculating on the whole thing across the board. And it's very interesting the approach he takes because he overlays modern technology. It'd be almost as if we went back in time and showed up and with some Black Hawk helicopters, led a little group of Egyptians out of Egypt, followed by a piece of royalty, Akhenaten. Followed by a piece of royalty with some Black Hawk helicopters, and we had some flamethrowers there. Well, you know, we come out of the tent in the meeting, we wanted to make a point to him, we hit him with a flamethrower. You know, basically what he's saying is any of the techniques of the Old Testament, stuff going on in the Old Testament, can it be explained with technology right in front of our face now? Maybe you've seen something like this on the Discovery Channel, trying to explain certain miracles of the Old Testament through modern technology. It's the third rail of speculation. It is interesting because it tears down our enemy's nationalism. But in short, what you need to understand is whatever happened in Exodus is cutting deals that are not like anything that the party that uses that title normally like. This isn't dealing with the Olympians building cities for white rabbits, you know, competing to build cities. This is radically different. He's murdering people. He's murdering, before he ever sends the Israelites out to murder anybody, rape, kill, pell and plunder and everything, Exodus, Leviticus, all that stuff. He starts by murdering them. He orders Moses to impale the leaders alive. When Aaron doesn't follow Moses or he's questioning Moses, he immediately calls him into the tent of the meeting. And it's kind of interesting how Yahweh finds out about it. It has something to do with the Uman and the Thuman. And what it sounds kind of funny. What Pharaoh's speculating is like some kind of walkie-talkie Yahweh had in his ship. And his ship, for all I know, could have been a Black Hawk helicopter. Who knows? Who knows? But he's speculating along this line, which is relevant because it's our enemy's mythology. But the one thing you need to understand in your enemy's mythology is that Moses has to always be obeyed. And Moses is hands off. The Elitsers are hands off. They're figureheads. They talk to God. They issue orders from Yahweh. You have to obey that. When Aaron or anyone else questions that, they get called into the carpet, if not murdered. You don't fool around when Moses issues orders because Moses speaks for Yahweh. Why? Why? Well, when you get into those pictures of Akhenaten, when you look at this guy, and you come to the conclusion that, one, you're dealing with someone claiming Anunnaki titles. They're claiming the titles of God. They're title of CEO on this planet. I'm here and I'm running things. You're dealing with something rather fascinating. He doesn't have their attributes. He looks human. He's huge. He's big. Even with Hammurabi, he's huge. Shamash is huge. And he names them. We're going to name them in a minute. I just let out a little hint. This character's huge. He also won't show his face in any conventional way. These are very unlike what you're dealing with when you're dealing with the Shining Ones, the gods, the Olympians, the Anunnaki, whatever you want to call them. You're not dealing with the conventional set. You're dealing with something else entirely, but yet is using their terminology, using their titles. And he's operating in a way that we've never seen. He's murdering people, right, left, and center, murdering people. And He goes on to name the character as Shamash, and you can look him up. You can look up this character. You're going to, if you Google Shamash, S-H-A-M-A-S-H, you're going to be able to see him talking to Hammurabi, interesting enough. He's talking to Hammurabi, and you're going to be able to see him in a variety of different pics. If you Google image, you're going to be able to see his size. He's very, very big. He doesn't show most of his head, generally most of the cuneiforms, if it's even his head at all. In the Old Testament, those that have cracked the thing say that based on the size of his tabernacle, he has to have a tent, he has to eat, he has to sleep. He only leads them by night, has them sleeping by day. And, of course, what Dr. Farrell's doing is something rather fascinating. He's basically overlaying modern psychological manipulation techniques. And let's face it, it's not often you can read about reverse depattering, psychic driving, and Stockholm Syndrome, and that the Jew God's a giant fallen angel, basically, an offspring. an offspring that would be in a lot of trouble if he were here. An offspring of fallen angels, for lack of a better word, using modern psychological techniques and maybe even advanced weaponry and advanced manipulation techniques to cut a deal with Moses to get back in the picture. It's not often that you read something like this from a doctor in patristics from Oxford in early church history. But if you want to write it, I'll push it. It's good stuff. And I will claim something. You know. Generally, people say, or is you only interested in that because you're an anti-Semite and this stuff is rather ruthless in the Old Testament? And I plead guilty. But you have to understand this is our enemy's mythology. They wage war by deception. So you have to know everything about their mythology. And I want to know who's here if he's here. Well, who is Shamash? And let's jump to that. I may jump around a bit in this podcast, and I apologize for that, but there's a lot to cover, and I'm going to try to skim over stuff and try to give you the necessary points. Shamash is generally thought to be another name for Nergal. Another name for Nergal. You mean we're into the Nergals, the Marduks, and the Eos, the Enkis, the Lokis, the Devil, and yes, Satanel, the whole nine yards. What you're dealing with here is a crew, by the way. What Pharaoh does and knocks it out of the park is he comes to the west of the west. And his premise is would be mine. If there's anything big in mythology that changes the picture on the planet, in, let's say, Egypt, in the Middle East, well, there should be something big on the planet other places. And he goes to the west of the west. He goes into the Aztec mythology, and where everything is pretty much untouched. We don't have major manipulations like we do in the Old Testament. And he talks about Quetzalcoatl. Quetzalcoatl was driven out, not in a literal sense probably, in some type of allegorical sense. He was driven out. They're trying to tell you something in Aztec mythology. And Yahuatl shows up. Now, Yahuatl, sound familiar? Yahweh, Yahuatl, shows up and institutes human sacrifice. You see, human sacrifice was not always around to the Aztecs. Human sacrifice was instituted, they say, by Yahuatl. Yahuatl and a band of sorcerers backed by a band of demons. See, that's one of the challenges here. You're dealing with a group. You're not necessarily dealing with one person. You're dealing with a group. You're dealing with the Eos, the Inkis. You're dealing with someone claiming to be CEO and board of directors. You're dealing with the Nergals, the Marduks. You're dealing with that crew and their offspring. And it becomes somewhat of a challenge. I can get you over top of it. I can point you in the direction of the truth if there is any such thing. I can get you around those that can explain it to you point by point. But one of the challenges here, you're dealing with allegories by and large. You're dealing with a green goddess type scenario where you have the green goddess talking to, in Zachariah Sitchin's, you're always dealing with this, by the way. Where he writes something, and you can look him up. Many of you wrote that Inky speaks. Those are his interpretations. They're not necessarily all accurate. And you're dealing with several different instances, in my opinion, where you have the green goddess talking to Godzilla and talking to Goodzilla, and at the same time talking to the Emerald Girl, when in fact you're all dealing with the same person that's trying to tell you something. That's one of the fascinating things. So the question comes, is Ea, Nergal, Marduk, are all these the same guy? I don't know, but they're all in the same crew. That's what you need to understand. And they're all in the revolting side of the pantheon that revolted against God with these tribes of giants and lost everything and got thrown down. You know, the devil got thrown down. And it becomes quite difficult. I can get you over it. I can get you in some of the most fascinating stuff like Dr. Farrell's writing about in Genes, Giants, Monsters, and Men. But the whole truth is still elusive to me. I can point you in the direction. And what is relevant to this? How is this relevant to Nimrod? Well, Nimrod, guess what? Is either Nergal or Marduk. He's just another name. It's another name, and we're going to get to that in a minute. And I'm going to explain to you why. What's the key to this puzzle, in my opinion? Horace, what's the key to this puzzle? What gives you the hardest time? And I'll tell you. Enki, Ea, has a son. And this son goes on a tirade. He built the Great Pyramids at breakneck speed. It's true. In the original deal, he builds the Great Pyramids. Now, Egypt, the Sphinx has all been refashioned. The pyramid has been gutted. If you read the ancient text, it's obviously been gutted. If the mythology, quote-unquote, is true. Now, we're going to assume in the third rail of speculation that it's true, and we're trying to find out who it is if it is true. But this child, this is a child of Enki. But as you're going to see in this next little clip, and this clip I did quite some time ago, in this clip, and I redid it a couple times, I just didn't know where to put it in this podcast, you're going to understand why it's so difficult when you get into Enki's children. You've got giants, and Enki is Poseidon. Poseidon is Kronos. Kronos has all these giants. These giants have now just come to life because I have fossils for the damn things, and we're going to get to them in a bit. So this war on this planet, to some extent, happened. We have stuff going on here. We have mythology coming to life. But when you get into his children, there becomes a great challenge. The challenge is one of these characters, and I call him Sci-Fi Louie. And you're going to hear this little piece. And after this little piece, I'm going to come back and I'm going to try to tie it in. And basically, in short, what you need to know is your enemy, by and large, our enemy, the Rockefellers, when you get into the Rockefeller and Rothschilds, it's overwhelming that these people believe that's what they're related to. That's why they're demigods. And you got some other elements in there. You got the Akhenatens and the Aarons, you know. You've got this dynamic where the elitesters have to be their figureheads, but they have a lot more power than you think. And you've got a group waging war by deception. They're obviously not telling us everything. Or they wouldn't have been successful for so many hundreds of years, you know. So we're going to get to that in a minute, but this next little piece of Sci-Fi Louie. At the end of that, you're going to realize why this is such a challenge, why this is such a head-scratcher. And this next piece, warning, is going to fry your brains a little bit. Because this is the craziest scenario I have ever heard about. But at the same time, based on the allegory given for Louie, we have to. Given the fact that this is a child of Enki, a Poseidon, described as his child, we have to go this direction, and this is, it's funny because, you know, it's so crazy that it may in fact be true. You know, generally if something's real crazy, I discount it, but you gotta watch when I discount something. So after this piece, I'm gonna come back and I'm gonna start tying it together. Or trying to. This next following piece should be up in the members-only area if you're not hearing it in a regular podcast. I'm going to go ahead and throw it up in the members-only area to answer some questions. The title is Louie and Sci-Fi. There's been a science fiction trend post-World War II that is pretty hard to ignore. And it's one thing over and over again. Some of the best-selling movies always revolve around this theme, and most of us don't know where it comes from. Where it comes from is pretty wild. And it's, of course, speculative, but I'm going to go over this in a way to answer the questions I have. And the questions are in regards to artificial intelligence. One common theme we've seen post-1950, well, even going back prior to that probably, is artificial intelligence goes wrong. You have really sophisticated artificial intelligence and it goes wrong and starts waging war on the people that invented it and so on. And it's kind of interesting. It always starts with artificial intelligence making irrational choices. Irrational choices. Now, I'm not saying every artificial intelligence movie is about that. No, some are quite interesting. Some go another direction as well. But some of the best-selling of all time go into this theme of artificial intelligence. And it centers around artificial intelligence screwing over humans. to put it bluntly, and I'm going to go over some of these different movies, and then we're going to get to the punchline, and I'm going to put up several things on my Twitter along with this. So if you're listening to this, look for my Twitter, look for Louie and Sci-Fi and the different Twitter pieces. I'm going to put up the Scene Stealers. Scenestealers.com put up the top 10 artificial intelligence movies of all time. And then we're going to do, there'll be a piece put up from, actually artificial intelligence and cinema, pure artificial intelligence computational agents. And there were several. The most famous, I think, was started with the Space Odyssey 1968. Who, of course, I think it's Hal, and he screws over the crew. But, there's always this theme. And this theme becomes really prominent, especially prominent in the 80s. In the 80s, and it starts in 1979, I believe, with the movie Alien. You might remember the movie Alien. The whole entire crew was screwed over by artificial intelligence, who lets an alien on the ship. Now, this is a very irrational choice. Very irrational choice. We don't analyze it from the standpoint of where they get this concept, and I'm going to go into that in a bit. But we look at it from a standpoint of, okay, he's artificial intelligence, he's not human, so he makes an irrational choice. But it's a very irrational choice. The odds of infection are nearly 100% for everyone but the artificial intelligence. The artificial intelligence doesn't have any emotion, it can't reason, it just calculates. It doesn't care about aliens. It wants to take the alien back to its boss or whatever. It's programmed. All it does is calculate. That's the problem with artificial intelligence. That's a challenge. It can't make human-type emotional distinctions. You know, letting an alien on the ship for a human, for any rabid listener, would be stupid. You have 100% infection. Even if you hate the crew, you're still probably going to get infected. Artificial intelligence doesn't think in those terms. But this is a theme that is very common. Some of the Star Trek generations... First Contact, where you deal with BAG, the cyborgs, the Borgs, where they are artificial intelligence, and they are a fusion of biology and artificial intelligence. Much the same as the alien theme, you're dealing with artificial intelligence is very irrational. All it does is calculate. The more famous that you've seen is probably The Matrix. The Matrix is very, very famous, and you've got... you've got the Agent Smiths, who all they do is calculate. They are artificial intelligence. They are programs running, and programs running with an agenda. Very interesting. They can flash in and flash out of our reality, and there's no reasoning with them. No, there isn't. But there's another case of artificial intelligence, usually making what seems to us to be irrational choices, and the reason they seem to be irrational choices to us is because artificial intelligence could only calculate. Common sense, right? Oh, Transformers was another one of artificial intelligence, but that is artificial intelligence coming to life, a little bit different. But you still have some artificial intelligence making your rational choices. The Terminator series has some of the most famous examples of this, of machines brought to life by humans, and these machines are making horrible choices. Horrible choices, but they're not choosing them based on any type of rational thought processes, they're just calculating. They're calculating the odds. They're calculating this, they're calculating that. And they also have one character in it, which is very interesting. I think it's a second Terminator, or maybe it's a third Terminator, where you have that ball of mercury. He's coming in and out. He can take the form of anything. Serious artificial intelligence. And he's a killing machine. You know, I forget what model Terminator it is, but we've all seen it. You know, it's the one, he takes the form of a cop mostly throughout the movie, but he can take the form of anything. It's almost a very similar theme to the Agent Smiths of the Matrix fame. Okay, Horace, where are you going with this? Well, I'm going to put some stuff up on the Twitters, and you can see all the different alien movies. And I am just glancing over some of the more famous ones. There are several different versions of artificial intelligence going crazy, screwing over humans, doing crazy inhuman things because it's not human, it's artificial intelligence, and can't reason, can't have any emotion, can only calculate. Where are we going with this, Horace? Well, that's a good question. The question is, Horace, do you know anything about Lucifer and artificial intelligence? The answer is yes. Yes, I know where this theme comes from. The theme comes from the Bible. As crazy as it sounds. When you get into this type of discussion, you're always going one direction. Even if you try to get out of it, and I've tried, you'll always end up in one direction. An ancient, paleo-ancient civilization burned down the solar system in a war. A couple million years ago or something like that. And they had some technology, some wild technology. And the speculation is always over one individual who makes a very irrational choice. And we've heard this our whole entire life, but you don't know where they get it from. I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. That's insanity. If heaven's heaven and hell is hell, serving pizzas in heaven is fantastic. They serve themselves. Carrot pizzas just go out automatically. It's heaven! The streets are made of gold! Think about this statement. This statement is totally irrational. Very common. I'd rather reign in hell than serve in heaven. Well, no one really serves in heaven. It's heaven. You just hang out. Chill out. Chill out with God. You know, eat yourself some carrot pizzas. The wine is flowing. No one ages. It's heaven. Hell is hell. Who in the hell would want to deal with all the crazy fools in hell? You got pink rabbits here. You got black rabbits. It's hell. It's insanity. It's an insane statement. But let's go over the particular Bible verse that's always used to talk about this stuff. And I'll tie it all together. It's pretty simple. And this is something that they're even shoving down our throats. And I'm going to add something to this, something I've added to this in the end here. Even yet another AI movie I'll end it with. But basically, when you get into the book of Ezekiel, that is where they're talking about. They're talking about, most speculate, Ezekiel 28:13, from there on out, they're talking about different references to Lucifer. And I am not a biblical scholar, I just know the basics. And the basics are quite simple. Thou hast been in Eden and the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering. The sardius, the topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tabrets and thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day thou wast created. Thou art the anointed cherub. This is always a reference to Lucifer on some level. Now the question is, what on earth is it? Is it some type of extended metaphor? Well, clearly. No one listening has ever heard any reference to any living creature, any human, any animal, as a jewelry store with fancy plumbing. And that's just what this character is described as. Onyx, jasper, sapphire, emeralds, diamonds, topaz, gold. He's got pipes. Pipes and jewelry. He's a jewelry store with fancy plumbing. Lucifer is a jewelry store with fancy plumbing, according to the Bible. Is this an extended metaphor for someone? It has to be. You don't refer to anyone human as a jewelry store with fancy plumbing. You don't refer to an animal as a jewelry store with fancy plumbing. You don't refer to a little gray alien as a jewelry store with fancy plumbing. I don't know what, where are they talking about? Well, the speculation is that this ancient this paleo ancient civilization, and there are many other references all around to Lucifer. And the references always end up in these extended metaphors. And what are they referring to? And there are many that believe they're referring to artificial intelligence. As crazy as that sounds. Artificial intelligence. Interesting stuff. Artificial intelligence gone wrong. Something that could... something like an Agent Smith, nearly. Something that many believe that one of the Terminator guys is modeled on to. He can come in and out of this world like liquid mercury. He can take form, but in the end, he can just calculate. Crazy? Absolutely nuts. But that's where the concept comes from. And let's face it, there is a story in the Bible about someone choosing, story in the Anunnaki, story in the Sumerian text, about someone choosing, that's the predecessor, choosing hell over heaven. He makes a conscious choice. But that's not a choice, it's not a rational choice. It's a very odd choice. You'd rather rule in hell than serve in heaven. You're not going to rule in hell for long. I mean, someone's going to come and nail you. This is insanity. He makes an insane choice. And how can he make an insane choice when he's a perfect angel? You know, thou sealest up the sum full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Thou art, hast been in Edom. You have been in the Garden of Edom. You walked on God's mountain. You're the anointed cherub. But he makes a horrible choice. He chooses hell for heaven. Very irrational choice. Humans don't even think about this, but if you think it through, you would never choose that at all. That doesn't make any sense. That's not a rational choice. It's kind of like being on a ship in outer space and choosing to let an alien on the ship with 100% risk of infection for the whole entire crew. That's an insane choice. Humans don't make those type of insane choices. We do a lot of crazy stuff. We don't do that. We don't go that crazy. But this character did some very crazy, irrational things, and the speculation is always down one path. that he is potentially AI, artificial intelligence, gone bonkers, a program. And let's not forget his crown. Louis has a crown. And his crown is not like Thor's hammer. His crown is not just a piece of equipment. He loses everything. He loses a great deal of power without his crown. Well, he can't make another one either, which is kind of odd. Because if Thor loses his hammer, make another hammer. Go see Odin. You know, when you start dealing with mythology and whatever you believe about the Bible, it's, you know. But you start dealing with this character and all the different elements of mythology that come in, all the different references to Louis, Lucifer, he's got problems without his crown. He's like someone took out his battery pack or something. So that's where the speculation comes in. Now, in all fairness, I'm going to add something in. I'm going to add this in and splice this in. My main sleuth has covered this, but from a pure biblical perspective. Joseph P. Farrell and his members-only area has covered this, but from a biblical perspective. And he talks about what monument this character is associated with building. Very interesting stuff. Now, it's all speculation, of course, but he is a biblical scholar, and he can speculate down that angle. I can only go at it from science fiction because it's all over the place. I don't want to reveal any of his proprietary stuff, but my understanding is he talks about it being a certain type of extended metaphor, potentially for AI. And you can get on there. It's a very short piece, $13, and he's got all kinds of interesting stuff on his members-only area. I don't want to reveal any of that stuff, but he goes into this from a totally different angle than I could. Totally different angle than I could. But it's all fascinating stuff. Traditionally, I have always thought Lucifer and all the characters he can be associated with to be this scenario to be an impossibility. Because Lucifer has children. Louis makes babies. And so how can Agent Smith make a baby? I mean, is that possible? When I think of artificial intelligence, I think of C-3PO, the cool ones. You know, C-3PO, R2-D2. They can't make babies. They can't do anything like that. They can't father children. Lead a rebellion, okay. Make an irrational choice, okay. They can't do that. And then, of course, in 2006, 2007, the big whammo came out. And you can look it up on Google. And that is synthetic DNA. Yeah, someone's bringing out synthetic DNA, which is caught a lot of people off guard. And that's when a lot of people started looking at this. What if you could do synthetic DNA? Could it procreate? Could it create a marker on a tribe so distinct that it could be traced no matter what? Well, certainly would. It led to a whole realm of speculation. So where I normally say this is an impossible scenario because Louis had babies, I would now bridge it based on science, based on artificial synthetic DNA, actual artificial intelligence, DNA type artificial intelligence, stuff that's beyond my comprehension, really. I don't know. I don't know. This is another wild thing. Like I said, I don't want to reveal any of Dr. Farrell's proprietary stuff, but he goes into this from a very clean biblical angle. And 2006, 2007 got a lot of people's attention, but this is a theme that they've driven down our throats through science fiction. I know where they got it. I just don't know where it's going, and I don't know what to do with some of these different science stuff coming out. And there is some more stuff about Louis and the different extended metaphors and what that means, the allegorical references in the Elitester special. Most of you don't understand, but you've been listening to an allegory. You've been listening to an extended metaphor. That's what Horse Avengers Follow the White Rabbit is, and there's two. One very simple, white rabbits. White rabbits are an allegorical representation of Indo-Europeans or Aryans. White people, if you will. Our race. And then, of course, there's another extended metaphor that gets a little deeper. And I did that for a reason. And that's the Green Goddess. The Green Goddess is an allegorical reference to white rabbit prowess, to all the crazy stuff we do, our technology, the good and the bad. But the Godzilla has two different names. In reality, she's going to have three different names. Godzilla, the Green Goddess, and the Goodzilla. Yeah, you haven't heard me talk about the Goodzilla yet. Why? Because Godzilla is trying to destroy something. But I'm going to go into that in the Leasters. It's important you know. So you're dealing with one concept. You're dealing with an allegory for Western technology. It's very real. And we're putting it into a character, and that character, of course, is Godzilla. But she actually has more than one name, And I've been using all these different names throughout the podcast up until this point, up until the point you hear this, no doubt about it. It's with the exception of Godzilla. You haven't heard that yet. In the cartoon, she's only called the Godzilla, as well as the Green Goddess, and maybe we'll make up a couple other names for it, but it's important for you to understand allegories, and it's important for you to listen to the first part of the Elitzer special to understand allegories when you're looking at ancient texts, when you're looking at the Greek myths, because all White Rabbit stuff is allegorical. It always is. There's multiple different references of the same thing, but the Green Goddess is pretty an advanced allegorical concept where the White Rabbits are very simple. She can be a little bit to get your mind around, and part of it is our race is not thinking under the natural situations that our race normally thinks under. Allegories normally, they certainly work for our race, they work for all my listeners, but we're not in our natural state. In our natural state, we deal with allegories and analogies quite a bit and quite easily from one to the other. But that's another story for another day. Look at the beginning special of the Leedster and you'll get a little bit about allegories. But these allegorical references, many believe, to certain types of artificial intelligence. And one last thing that I'm going to have to splice in and throw in here because this stuff keeps coming. I'm going to put this up on the Twitter. And the title of the piece, this comes out on December 15th, 2010. Tron Legacy. It's God versus Lucifer in a virtual world. And Tron Legacy, which I haven't seen, there's two different programs at war in the particular matrix, if you will. And Lucifer is, of course, artificial intelligence that tries to take the place over. Very interesting, but it's a concept. Again, I'm going to put this piece up, and you can read about it. If you've seen Tron Legacy, you know the general theme. Artificial intelligence making irrational choices because it's artificial intelligence. You know, I'd rather rule in hell than reign in heaven. That doesn't make any sense. That makes zero sense. Perfect cherubs don't make mistakes. Perfect cherubs shouldn't make irrational choices. Unless you're talking about some type of extended metaphor for some type of machine that got out of hand. And when humans lose a crown, well, you know, he's still a king without a crown. Louis loses his crown, he loses a lot of power, which doesn't make any sense either. Why wouldn't he make another one? Well, all he can do is calculate, is what the speculation is. It's what the speculation is. But anyways, that's my piece on Louis and sci-fi. You can go join up on Dr. Farrell and read it and ask him some different questions about these different concepts. I talk about Louis again in the Leedster special, and you'll be hearing that. Hopefully, you might have heard it already by the time you hear this piece. I don't know. But Louis is an interesting character, speculating on who it is. But we're dealing with a Green Goddess-type scenario where you've got one individual called multiple different names. You understand this. And I go into this in the Leedster special. But anyways, that is Louis and sci-fi.